Welcome to the Andy Dare Show. This is episode 22. This week I'm joined by Peter Jesperson, an iconic record man. We talk about his interesting journey. Enjoy. Thank you everybody so much for tuning into the Andy Dare Show. I'm your host, Andy Dare, and today I have the honor and privilege of interviewing Peter Jesperson. How you doing, Peter?
I'm doing very well, thanks. How are you?
Very good. Just been really into the whole story of the Twin Cities this last summer. Been reading up on the book, The Replacements, All Over But the Shouting, and just my mind's been blown about it. I find so many parallels within my own life, and I thought you'd be the one to really, get the truth and knowledge out of the story. So,
all right, I'll give it a shot.
Awesome. Like, if my listeners want to find out more about what you're up to now, is there a website they can go to?
Yeah, absolutely. I do A&R and production at New West Records in Los Angeles. Actually, we have offices in Austin, Texas, and Athens, Georgia as well, but the main office is in L.A., and it's New West Records, and you can look it up on the Internet just as, you know, newwestrecords.com. We've got about 15 artists on the label at the moment. Probably best known would be Kris Kristofferson, John Hiatt, Old 97s, Steve Earle. We also work with Delbert McClinton and Buddy Miller, and we've got some new groups from Texas, Ponderosa, actually, sorry, from Georgia, and a couple groups from Texas, Wild Moccasins, Buxton, and a young country folk writer by the name of Robert Ellis.
That is really cool. Yeah, I've been checking out the roster, and it's very stacked. You guys got quite a busy schedule coming up. I see the Tom Morello album coming out August 30th as well, right?
Yep, we're working with him. In fact, that's part of what I'm doing right now. We're working on not only the two records that we put out an EP in July and an album coming August 30th, as you said. We're also doing, and this is Tom Morello under the name The Night Watchman, and he did two records previously, and we are licensing those from him now and reissuing them on New West, and so I'm working on putting the packages together on those things and proofing lyrics right here at this moment when you called.
Really? Cool.
Yeah.
And I see you got the Drive-By Truckers, Greatest Hits, that's out now. Those guys really don't get enough credit. I think they're one of the greatest touring bands out right now. How do you say about them?
Well, you know, they've. It's funny, I've known Patterson Hood, the singer, since before there was a Drive-By Truckers. I've worked in Athens, Georgia, a lot over the years, almost 30 years now. It's kind of been my home away from home for a number of reasons, largely because I got involved with the REM guys in their very early days and did a bit of work with them. Also because I worked with the Replacements and we toured through Athens a lot. They were very well loved in Athens, and so it's just a town where... you know, I've got a lot of ties. So so the Drive-By Truckers actually formed, I think, in the early 90s. And I remember getting the first cassette. The first thing they ever released was a cassette. And so I followed them all the way through. And, we did several records with them. They're actually over at ATO now for their last two albums. But we still have five titles in the catalog. And we just did this Greatest Hits, which was a lot of fun to put together. The song selection was pretty much a no-brainer, but we wanted to make it extra special, and I wrote to my old friend David Frick, who's at Rolling Stone magazine these days, and asked if he, knowing he was a huge fan of the band, as it sounds like you are, wondered if he'd want to contribute liner notes for the record, and he jumped at the chance. It's pretty hilarious to have David Frick saying thanks for... offering this to me when I'm thinking, you know, he's only the, best known and maybe the greatest rock writer on the planet. You know, I think we're pretty fortunate to have him as well.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
And you got the new John Hiatt. I'm really loving the new John Hiatt record, Dirty Jeans and Mudslide Hymns. Are you aware of Adam Carolla?
I'm not.
He's actually got the most downloaded podcast in America right now. He was in TV and radio a lot in the 90s, did The Man Show on Comedy Central and stuff. But anyways, he's got the most downloaded podcast, and he's in L.A. He does five shows a week, and he just talks about John Hiatt all the time, about how he's his favorite performer and stuff. I think John Hiatt should actually try to get on that show, because it would be an instant, 250,000 ears on the new album and stuff like that. So I always thought that would be a good idea to get those two guys together, because he's always given a lot of praise on John Hiatt. So.
Well, I'll keep that in mind. You know, I would go as far as to say I think this Hyatt record is, it's the fifth one he's brought to New West, and I think it's really, in all seriousness, a contender for best record New West has ever released. I think it's just a masterpiece, and I really can't get over how strong a record it is. I think it's as good a record as he's ever made. Maybe I would go as far as to say as good as you know, his probably his most famous record, Bring the Family.
Yeah, I mean, and the production values were definitely beefed up. You got Kevin Shirley, who's done a lot of good stuff with like the Black Crowes, Aerosmith, and I think he really pumped up the production values on there. So
he did. You know, it was really it made it quite dramatic because John had produced the last two records himself, and they sound really good. But you know, self-produced records always have a little bit of a different, you know, vibe to them, and then to go from those to this. Production where the producer actually sought John out, you know, called John's manager, and this has been in a lot of interviews, but he famously said, I think I know where John's trying to get to, and I think I can help him get there. And John's manager relayed it to John, said, I don't think anybody had ever said that to me, and I took the chance to, you know, do a couple of test recordings with him just to see how it went, and it went so well, they decided, hell yeah, let's do an album together. And I agree, the production is remarkable.
Yeah, I can hear chemistry coming out the ears right there for that album.
And the singing, I mean, the singing is just ridiculous, and I suppose that's a result of him feeling, you know, what an incredibly strong batch of songs he had. But to me, it's the vocals that really are the high point of the record. I don't think he's sung this well from top to bottom on a record in years and years and years. And as I said to somebody the other day, when he's on, he's the blackest white guy around.
Yeah, he's got the grit and the soul, for sure.
Yeah.
But yeah, I'd like to take it back for my listeners. How about like the first moment that the rock and roll really affected your life, and when you really fell in love with the art form?
Well, that's a tough one. I mean, I think I sort of have a really hazy but specific memory of hearing All I Have to Do Is Dream by the Everly Brothers. If I heard it when it was new, I would have been about four. You know, I don't recall exactly. I mean, I could have heard it the year after it was a hit or whatever. But so that would have been 1958. I was born in 54. And so that was something that just lit me up initially. But the real lightning bolt, I think, came down like it did for so many people when I first heard I Want to Hold Your Hand by the Beatles on the radio. And January of 64, I was just about to turn 10. Mm-hmm. And it was really like, you know, I put my finger in an electrical socket or something. It was a life-changing moment. And then, of course, just a couple weeks later, they were on the Ed Sullivan Show, and me and, you know, millions of other people saw them. You know, I don't think I, at that point, I just, I think my destiny was sort of determined without me really knowing it.
It was already written by that point in the stars, yeah.
I was at that point. I became a fanatic, and it's never let up for a moment since then.
Nice. How did it affect your high school years? Did rock and roll music take a backseat, or was it still in the forefront during your high school years?
Oh, it was definitely at the forefront. I mean, all the way through. I probably goofed off more in junior high and got my act together in senior high, but I was still, you know, playing the, you know, listening to records and you know, building a record collection and finding new groups and expanding. I mean, originally, it's kind of funny to think this now, but the only bands that I remember initially were trustworthy enough to buy full albums by were the Beatles and the Rolling Stones. And everybody else you bought singles by. And then, of course, then I got wise to Bob Dylan, who I'd always liked, but I hadn't really connected with. He was a little more, you know, for a 10-year-old, it was a little tougher. But as I got a little more into my teen years, then Dylan became a big thing. And then, you know, you start buying records by other people. I went crazy over the Byrds or... the Procol Harum was a huge band for me back in those days. The first Neil Young records that started coming out at the end of the 60s were life-changing records for me, especially his first record. I just thought that was, to me, still one of the, I don't know, 25 best rock records ever made.
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah, this is why I had an instant connection with your story, because I kind of grew up in a record store myself, and I'm only 27, so I'm kind of like out of that range, but it really hit me hard. Like, my dad would take me in the stroller to Remember When Records in Westmont, Illinois, and they're actually just closing their doors after 28 years.
So sad.
Yeah, it's really affecting the whole country. They're all slowly shutting down, but we'll always have the memories, and you can't really take those away from us. But yeah,
I think record, there's going to be, you know, the sturdy record stores in lots of places. I mean, we're lucky here in LA. There's like 5 or 6 great record stores here. But I know one of my best friends lives out in the Washington D.C. area, and he has literally 0 record stores now since, I guess, Tower closed. And I want to believe that there's going to be outposts there forever. I don't think they're all going to disappear. But
yeah,
sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you.
Oh, no problem at all. But yeah, they started falling like dominoes in Chicago, and now we got the Reckless Record Chain, which is a good independent record store chain in Chicago. There's 4 of them, or
right.
There's 3 stores. But yeah, they're still doing good. They're, you know, even doing well with the new vinyl boom. But yeah, so my store is closing. I worked there for 4 years after high school, just really soaked it all in. And so you had Orfolk Jokopis. Could you explain that to my audience here?
The record store name?
Yeah, explain the name, and then just, you know, like, when did you start there and how it affected you?
Well, the store actually was purchased by a guy. It's got a little bit of involved story. It was originally called North Country Music, owned by a guy named Wayne Clayman. So it was already a really cool record store, and I shopped there, and then Wayne sold it to a guy named Vern Sandin. Vern wanted to change the name. Vern was also a record collector and thought he would name it after 2 of his favorite obscure records. So he picked Or by Skip Spence, who was the old drummer of Jefferson Airplane and then rhythm guitar for Moby Grape. And he had made a solo record in 1968 called Or. It was the first record I ever knew about that one guy played all the instruments on, so it was pretty groundbreaking. And a very strange but wonderful record. And then Folk Joke Opus was an album by a British, kind of an eccentric, brainy folk singer by the name of Roy Harper. And he just basically fused 3 words together, folk, joke, and opus, and invented a word that hadn't existed before. So we just put those 2 together and made it Or Folk Joke Opus, and it was abbreviated as Or Folk. I had started doing some work for the New Musical Express, the British rock paper, in 1972, just distributing them in the Minneapolis-St. Paul area when I was just coming out of high school. And that came through my father, who worked for a publishing company, and the New Musical Express wanted to go into competition with Melody Maker, which was the only other British rock paper being imported at the time. So I got to know all the people at the record stores, and through that relationship, I mean, I was shopping there all the time anyway, but that made me a little more involved with the inner workings of the store. And so when this Vern Sandin took over, I guess in January of 73, he and I had a couple conversations, and he ended up hiring me in April of 73, and I worked there for 10 years. And I was moved up to manager in 74, and so I managed the store for 9 of those years.
That is so awesome.
Yeah, that was my college. You know, it was everybody has their fond memories of their, you know, their youth. But boy, that was it was much more than a record store. It was really the clubhouse for the underground rock scene in Minneapolis. Everybody hung out there, and we didn't know it at the time, but it was it was really sort of the, I don't know, ground zero for Minneapolis rock scene. Everybody hung out because we had the records that other places didn't have.
How did the record store get you into wanting to form Twin Tone?
Well, I think, as I said, it was kind of the clubhouse there. Everybody hung out, and we sort of joked about it over the years, but Twin Tone was started by myself and a producer by the name of Paul Stark, and they... a sports writer of all things by the name of Charlie Hallman, and we have sort of all said we were practically forced into existence by the number of, you know, great rock and roll bands in Minneapolis at the time. So I guess that, working at the record store just put me in the kind of the crow's nest, and I could really see, I had a great overview of the scene. Also, there was an underground rock club called the Longhorn that I DJ'd at and was a bit of a booking advisor for. So I saw a lot of other, you know, a lot of bands that I might not have seen, just through my involvement with the club. And so it was, we just thought somebody's got to record these bands. And it was the early days of the indie rock movement. We were pretty turned on by labels like Berserkly here in the United States, and of course the British, you know, and bands like the Ramones and stuff, and then the British punk scene, of course, with the Pistols and the Clash and the Damned and Elvis Costello and all that stuff.
Cool. Was there like a flagship artist or a first band that you guys really put all your efforts into? Or?
Well, I think that my main reason for wanting to start a label was to record a guy named Kurt Olmstead, who is a bit of a, I don't know, we called him the Mitch Ryder of Minneapolis. I don't know if you know Mitch Ryder, but...
Detroit Wheels, right?
Yeah, yeah. He was like a white soul shouter, and Kurt had a lot of Mitch Ryder in him, but Kurt also had his own thing in that he also loved the British Invasion stuff. So it was really a blend of American rhythm and blues and the British Invasion with a heavy dose of, you know, Beatles in there. So Kurt really appealed to me. He was a great vocalist, and so we signed his band, which was called Thumbs Up, was the first band that we brought into the label. By the time we finished the recording, they had changed their name to Spooks. But significantly, the guitar player and sidekick for Kurt was Bob Dunlap, who later became Slim Dunlap when he joined the Replacements.
Oh.
But the initial releases on Twin Tone actually were 3 7-inch EPs. Spooks, another group called Fingerprints, who were a bunch of old high school mates of mine who also had a recording studio. And then a third band that were the young upstarts with a bass player, I think, who just learned to play a couple of weeks before we started working with them. And they were called The Suburbs, and they went on to become the biggest band in Minneapolis for years.
Oh, sure. How about the first impressions of the guys from the Replacements, Paul especially?
First impressions, geez, you know, Paul came in and brought me a demo cassette in May of 1980, and I just thought, you know, he's kind of a cool-looking, you know, kid. I mean, I was a couple years older than him, and he was probably 19 at the time, and but I didn't know him, and he just gave me this cassette, and I was getting a lot of cassettes at the time, so I wasn't sure if he was giving it to me as an audition for Twin Tone or to try to get a gig at this club, the Longhorn, where I DJed. But anyway, I listened, and I just fell in love with it instantly. And when I saw them, I mean, it was just, I mean, they were, it was one of those things, like, sure, they developed and they got better, but they were, it was all there immediately. The first time I saw them, it was like, oh my God, it was just really exciting, and it was irreverent, and it was funny. I think people forget how much having an element of humor, and I don't mean, you know, bad jokes or anything. I mean, you know, just an element of humor in music can really make a difference. And they had a great, you know, funny streak for sure. So, you know, meeting them, I mean, you know, Tommy was 12. They were all such different. They all had such, you know, distinct personalities. We just got along like, you know, gangbusters right away.
Yeah, I think humor is totally missing nowadays in rock and roll music. Everybody thinks they're so self-righteous and whatnot. But
yeah, it's a little sad. We saw Nick Lowe here in L.A. last week, and he said in an interview before he performed, he said, my enemy is Ernest. He said I have a problem with Ernest, and I do too. I thought that was a funny comment,
Totally.
I mean, I like some Ernest, but not too much Ernest.
Yeah, how was Bob? I heard Bob was really like the one guy who would always hang out at the record store and read all the record magazines. How was his knowledge about the musical scene going on? And did his knowledge kind of carry the Replacements, or was it more of Paul?
Oh, well, I mean, Bob was really the guy who put the band together. He was a voracious reader and you know, was just a rock and roll fanatic. And so he was the one that really put the band together. You know, he found Chris and then sort of famously bribed Tommy to learn to play the bass guitar, and they had their little core, and Bob kind of tried to sing initially, and then they'd have a couple other guitar players, a couple other guys who sang, and then Paul came along, and of course Paul took it over in a lot of ways because he had that gift for the writing, and you know, was just sort of a natural front man. But Bob was the key figure in the start of the whole thing, and you know, he's as unique an individual as I have ever known. I mean, just a absolutely when they made him, you know, they threw the mold away. I've never met anybody else like him.
That's awesome. Yeah, I've heard he's like he was like Sam Kinison with a guitar. Or,
well, maybe. That's not a bad description.
Just like a bigger-than-life character.
Yeah.
But, yeah, you said the band was pretty much already formed as far as having all the elements together when you first met him. Was Sorry Ma, was that easy or difficult to record? Was there work ethic there, or was that still something that they had to work towards?
Well, there were two problems. One is that, you know, there were certain groups that had some cachet and had a following and had a certain popularity, I guess you'd say, that kind of maybe got first dibs on, you know, whatever little money we had at Twin Tone to record. And fortunately, in the early days, we got into business with these guys in the band Fingerprints, and kind of my partner Paul Stark had a studio, and he combined his stuff with the Fingerprints gear, and so we had a little bigger, better studio with the combination of the two parties there, and that made it a little easier for us to record, so we didn't have to be going to some outside party and writing a check or giving them cash, and we wanted to do a recording session. It was kind of like, you know, we would do sort of barter and trade on time, and Paul Stark owned the house where the guys ended up putting all the recording gear, and so it's like it's a little complicated. But anyway, it meant that there wasn't a lot of cash outlay, but still there were bands that sort of maybe got first shot at the studio time. So the Replacements, you know, I loved them, but other people were not as convinced early on. So I had to really fight to get them into the studio. That's one thing. And then also trying to capture what they did on tape was a little tricky. And what we thought we'd originally do was maybe the best thing was we had access to some mobile recording gear through my partner Paul Stark. And we thought, you know what, we could run that cables into the Longhorn and record them on a stage during off hours when the club wasn't open and try to capture that you know, that live manic feel that they had. And you know, it really failed. It didn't
really
work. I don't think we used any of that stuff, so we ended up going back to the studio, which was in this house over in sort of southeast Minneapolis area called Dinkytown near the University of Minnesota. And it's where Bob Dylan sprung from, by the way. It's really made
cool.
Dinkytown famous. But anyway, we recorded in this house over there, and they ended up calling the studio after they combined the gear. They called it Blackberry Way, which was named after a song by The Move, great English rock band.
Oh, yeah.
And so we ended up doing the recording over there, and so that's where we found our sea legs, so to speak, in the recording. But it also, we couldn't just go in for, you know, a lockout for 2 weeks and get it all done, you know. So we had to go in. We'd go in for a day or two here and a day or two there, and like I said, over the course of time, trying to figure out how it was all going to be done. That album took longer to make than you would think. I mean, it sounds like it was just a blast, like you hit record and it was done, but it really did take, I don't know, 7 or 8 months to do
really?
Piecemeal. Yeah. So we started recording, I think we started recording in July of 80, and those were just the demos to figure out how many songs the band had, and then recorded a lot in the fall and through the winter, and then finished the record by the spring, and it came out in September of 81.
Yeah, the reissue shows that there was sure a lot of stuff that didn't even make the album, too. It's so stacked at like 28 tracks or something now.
31 on that reissue. Yeah, there was 18 on the original album, and I had 13 extra tracks on it, so there's 31 on the reissue.
That's awesome. How about like other upstart labels at the time? Did you ever find any competition with like SST or Discord or any of those that were like doing the same thing, you know, not having a lot of money, but still with a lot of talent on their rosters?
Yeah, well, no competition. I mean, that was all, everybody was glad that there was somebody else in other areas doing, you know, because generally speaking, in those days, the labels were a little bit regional. Discord was a lot of DC bands, and SST was a little more West Coast, although, of course, they had Husker Du. You know, we centered around Minneapolis and sort of the five-state area. We had a couple bands from Wisconsin and branched out a little bit later. But yeah, they were regional scenes. So it was cool to have the labels representing a specific geographic place. And you know, we didn't feel competition at that time. It was nice to have other people, you know, carving a path, because You know, the Discord bands would fan out from the D.C. area and find clubs sort of in between D.C. and New York and between D.C. and Chicago. And that was advantageous to us when we started trying to get from Chicago to D.C. or from Chicago to New York. And then, you know, we could always host bands in Minneapolis. If it was a good band, we could support them through the record store and through the Longhorn, and like even REM, when they first came to Minneapolis, you know, they didn't have an audience outside of the Southeast, and they were playing for 5 or 10 people in a lot of places.
Wow.
They got to Minneapolis, and I think we had 120 people or something the first time they came to town, and they were blown away. They couldn't believe it. But we'd all been so crazy about that Radio Free Europe single. We've sold, you know, I'm sure we sold boxes and boxes of it, hundreds, because it was clearly just such a striking record. And so, you know, that's just what happened back in those days. It was really a great thing to be a part of, and to support other like-minded people at labels and you know, bands and whatnot.
Yeah, extend the olive branch, you know, put the welcome sign out when bands from across the country are touring in places by you. I like that a lot.
Yeah, exactly.
How about, like, the most important thing that you learned at Twin Tone that you're now applying at New West?
Wow. I mean, I guess the most important thing is that one of the things I like best about rock and roll is there really aren't any rules. And I think that every situation is unique, and you certainly learn things as you go along and get, you know, hopefully better at your job. But I think you've got to be kind of ready for anything, and it, you know, I guess, not to sound too altruistic about it, but it has to start with the music, you know, for me, I guess I'm not exactly a businessman. I don't think, I have to be madly in love with something to do the kind of job that I want to do. And so thankfully I'm in a situation where I get to work with records that I'm madly in love with. So I guess that's what I've learned, is to stick with what you really love. And it's not, I mean, I don't think it should be about the money. I think that's the secret of my longevity in the record business, is I'm a cheap date. I don't really care about the money, and I just want to make, great records. And
more about putting out the great records. Yeah.
Yeah.
Let It Be Records. Have you heard of that record store?
Of course. Ryan Cameron, old friend of mine who started that store.
Cool. Yeah, I used to go there a lot when I used to visit my cousins up in the Twin Cities. They're still around, right?
I don't think it's a physical store. I think he does some things under the name Let It Be. Maybe I know he was the kind of guy that got into record collecting and trading and bought record collections. And so I know he had like a couple warehouses full of records. So I think it's more of a online mail order kind of deal.
Oh,
maybe a lot
you.
Of eBay. I haven't followed it for a while, and I haven't seen Ryan for some years now, but I think he's still active in that world.
Well, I put two and two together when I was really getting into the Mats, and I realized that is a reference to the Mats, not the Beatles. Am I correct? Or?
Well, I think it's a reference to both. I think that the reason he picked it was because he loved the Beatles and he loved the Replacements, so it was sort of funny, you know, in a way. You know, I'd never really talked to him about why he chose that name, to be honest.
Oh, right. I know that you used to tour a lot with the Replacements, actually get in the van. Is that true?
Yeah, I guess I was the road manager as well as the manager.
Any good memories at a Chicago venue?
Oh, boy. Chicago was so exotic to us. The first time we went to Chicago, Husker Du took us along, actually. I remember it pretty clearly because we had to borrow a van from the suburbs because we didn't have our own van yet. And they happened to not be working that weekend, so I borrowed their van, probably slipped them a few bucks, and we followed Husker Du down, played a club called O'Banion's. If I'm not mistaken, if my memory serves, it was on Clark Street. And it was a real down and dirty punk rock club. I remember to get to the dressing room, you had to go through a trap door behind the stage. And it was freezing cold, and the club had no heat. I think it was maybe 40 below wind chill when we got into Chicago, and then they told us there was no heat in the club. And we're like, oh, all right. that was actually, you know, we always brought a boom box along. This is before the days of having fancy stereo systems in vans. And we had a boombox, which then I would record the shows on. And I recorded that show at O'Banion's, and they did a brand new song that night called "Kids Don't Follow." And it was just electrifying. It was so great. And I thought, you know, now looking back on it, of course, a little naivete, of course, but I thought, this is a hit. You know, this is a big anthem. And so I got back to Minneapolis and convinced my Twin Tone partners to letting the band record again, even though we just put the first album, Sorry Ma, just come out 6 months before. But we went ahead and recorded "Kids Don't Follow" and the other current songs, and ended up, you know, making the Stink EP, which came out less than a year after the first album, which at that time was pretty uncommon, especially for a band that hadn't caught on yet and didn't have any money. And a lot of people were pretty pissed off about that. A lot of other bands said, "Hey, we should be making records. What are these? What are these, you know, young upstarts doing? And how come they get to make two in a year?" And that sort of thing. But that was a great memory of Chicago, and we did well there, and ended up going to Chicago a lot, and over the years, and had a great time there, great fan base.
It was the touring a part of the reason that Stink came out as such a pretty like hard, almost hardcore punk for the Replacements. Was that like a conscious decision to make a really like a tough record after the debut?
No, they, well, for one thing, they hadn't really toured. I mean, we got to Chicago. That was as far away as I think we'd gone. We might have done, you know, we did Duluth, Minnesota. We might have been to Madison, Wisconsin. We had kind of a freak incident where we were invited down to Lawrence, Kansas to play just because there was a radio station down there, KJHK, which was a great college radio station. And they banged the hell out of the Replacements records. And Sorry Ma got to number one on their charts, and they actually came up with enough money to, you know, bring us down. And so we hadn't really toured at that time. I think that the sound of the record was Paul trying to sort of play ball with his contemporaries a little bit, because, again, we were a little bit sucked into that Husker Du world and a lot of the other sort of hardcore-ish bands of that time. And even though that wasn't really what the Replacements were all about, I think Paul kind of dipped his toe in the water there. And had we not recorded Stink, some of those songs might have just gone by the wayside, sadly. So I'm glad we did. But, I mean, you know, I need a goddamn job and fuck school, if I can say such a thing on...
Sure, you can say. White and lazy.
On your podcast. You know, I think those were things that were...
needed,
you know,
to be said. Yeah.
I mean, they still hold up again, you know, a great sense of humor in those tracks. A little like a Ramones song or something.
Sure. Yeah. How about like the scariest moment ever touring with the Mets, like involving like violence? Or I know that they were quite a party band, and I'm sure some stuff went down on tour. What was like the scariest moment?
Scariest moment. God.
Or regarding police, or I don't know. Venue owners.
Well, you know, I guess you know, there was some rambunctiousness in a dressing room in Davis, California, where some things got broken and we skedaddled out of town and found out afterwards that there was a warrant out for my arrest and the police were looking for us, and we kind of suspected that might be the case, so we left real quick.
Band on the run. Yeah.
Yeah, that eventually went away because by that time we had a booking agent. And when he got wind of the trouble, you know, he told the promoter that he would cover the costs if we didn't. But he said they're honorable people. They maybe had, you know, if they're responsible for it, they'll pay for it. But if they don't, I will. So they withdrew the warrant, and we ended up having to pay for some damage done to a dressing room at the college there in Davis. That was pretty uncomfortable. I don't know if I'd say it was scary, but it was uncomfortable.
Yeah, that works.
Yeah.
How about like the last time ever speaking with Mr. Bob Stinson, and how did it go down?
Wow. You know, I actually remember it, and I was at Twin Tone, and he came in with a new girlfriend, and he wanted to introduce her to me, and in all seriousness, her name was Anna Nimity. And I don't know if that was a made-up name or whatever, but I was like, wow. And And Bob, I was on the phone when he stuck his head into my office and had this girl with him, and I kind of signaled him, like, give me 1 second, I'll get off the phone. And I remember hearing him say something to his girlfriend, which I will never forget. He said he was the fifth, you know.
Oh, nice.
And I remember thinking he didn't know I heard that, and I kind of gulped and maybe lost my train of thought with whoever I was talking to on the phone. I thought, well, what a sweet thing for Bob to say.
That's awesome.
And that was the last time I saw him.
Huh. Well, are you still in touch with Mr. Paul Westerberg? Or?
I am off and on. You know, he's not a real sociable guy. I usually see him when I go back to Minneapolis. Occasionally we'll talk on the telephone. Haven't talked to him for a while now, though, to be honest.
Any intentions of having Paul sign with a New West?
Well, you know, we had talked about doing some stuff around the time he was doing the Mono Stereo records. The gentleman who owns New West and I had flown out to Rhode Island, where Paul's manager lived, and we were about to do a deal, and it just ended up not quite working out for either party. So, you know, what we do at New West is really much more touring-based, and Paul doesn't want to tour, so I don't think it would make sense to do a record here.
Gotcha.
Yeah. Much as I'd love another crack at, you know, I think I could help make a great record, but, you know, if he would... If he wanted to, I think we could make another great record together, or a few great records together.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure. Well, never say never. I mean.
Yeah, exactly.
All right. Well, every show I like to do a list with my guest, and I thought it fitting to talk to Peter Jesperson about our top five Matt songs. And
okay.
Reason why I love the band, I mean, I think they're similar to Nirvana in that, like, Nirvana wasn't the greatest technical players, but they knew enough about the history and the annals of rock and roll that they could kind of fake their way through it. And do you agree with that statement a little bit?
Sure. I mean, I was never a huge fan either, but, you know, I certainly give them credit for what they did and respect them.
Yeah, and they brought the attitude and the danger to the rock and roll music, and that's something that's sorely missing these days, I think. So.
I agree.
All right, I'm going to start off with my number five, and I didn't really go for the real hard-to-find cuts. I just went with my gut and picked five songs that I'm just in love with. So my number five is Color Me Impressed off Hootenanny.
Right.
And, yeah, I just think that the lyrics combined with the emotional power of the music really stuck out to me, especially on Hootenanny, which was really like they were just, you know, experimenting in the studio and having fun with it. And but this song really stuck out to me as Greatest Hits Fodder. And I heard R.E.M. covered it, and I would love to hear Michael Stipe's given a chance to that song. But
I don't remember R.E.M. covering that, but...
I think it said it in the book, actually, that Peter Buck loved it so much that he had R.E.M. cover it one day or something.
It might have just been a one-off thing.
Yeah, one-off.
A show or something, yeah. I don't remember that part, but...
But I love the line about everybody at your party, they look so depressed. You know,
right.
I totally agree with that line. Totally
sure.
Have felt that before in my life. How about your number five, Peter?
My number, I didn't really put them in order. I just had five, but I guess I can give you, I would say, Within Your Reach is the fifth one on my list.
For sure. That was done with a drum machine that was owned by the Suicide Commandos or something? Or?
Yeah, Dave All. It was a Dr. Rhythm that Dave All owned, the drummer of the Suicide Commandos.
And didn't Paul kind of sneak in the studio to do that without the guys? Or?
Yep, we went in. I bought some studio time for him solo to see if he'd want to, you know, give it a shot, because he'd been doing some solo stuff that I thought was really remarkable. And so we thought, let's see if we can just do this on the QT, and ended up recording three songs. One was a cover of September Girls by Big Star. One was a song called Warning Sound, which never got finished. Actually, part of it became We're Coming Out. On Let It Be, and then the third one was Within Your Reach.
Did he do the version of September Girls with the Dr. Rhythm? Or?
No, he didn't. It was, I believe, that we erased pretty quick. He didn't really like the way it came out. I didn't think it turned out great either. It was, I think, just acoustic guitar.
Oh, I got you. Well, my number four is Androgynous. It just really stuck out to me on Let It Be as something completely different, you know, just Paul with a piano and some sort of shaking percussion behind it. Lyrics that were really important back in the 80s, especially when it seemed like gender gender roles were kind of breaking down more, it seems like, and you couldn't tell who was the boyfriend or the girlfriend. I thought that was just really clever lyrics and just really paints a picture of 1984. So.
Sure, an important song.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, in their canon, as it were.
Of course. How about your number four, Peter?
As we talked about, Kids Don't Follow.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I love that, how the Minneapolis police break it up in the beginning. And
yeah.
It sure sounds live, but I guess in the book it said that you guys actually did that in the studio, but just mixed it in with the audio from the police.
Well, we had done a show right around that same time where, the police broke up the show, and my friend Terry Katzman was doing sound for them and was rolling tape. And when the police stopped the show, he shut the tape off, but then when he saw the cops going up to the microphone to get, everybody's attention, he wisely hit record again. And so we had that preserved, and we just thought it was so funny. And, so we just put that on the beginning, and, Kids Don't Follow was a studio recording.
Yeah, once again, bringing humor to the rock music. I really like that. And,
Yeah,
my number three is a darker cut off the same Stink EP. I love Go.
Oh, that was a... one of my favorites too. And they didn't do that live for a long time, so it was a studio-only track. And I don't think they ever really did it justice live. It was so, that's I think a really unique in the Replacements, song.
Talk about giving birth to like college rock and grunge all at once. It just seemed like the dark side of the early '90s music was so influenced by, especially the Stink EP. How they just were. Kind of dangerous and dark, and I really enjoyed it.
Right.
How about a third one, Peter?
All Shook Down.
All right.
I think that's, you could be subtitled that one, The Ballad of the Replacements. I mean, I think that's, in a weird way, almost Westerberg's peak of those early years, or of the Replacements years, I should say, if you're talking about from 1980 to now. I thought the writing on that was just absolutely remarkable. I was stunned senseless the first time I heard it, and I knew exactly what he was talking about. It was the end of the band. He knew it, and that's what that song's about. And lines like, "You got the black and white blues, man, I got them in color." I tell you,
that's a deep one.
Yep.
Off the Swan Song. So, number two, I got I Will Dare, of course, guitar featured by Peter Buck, and just a really swinging beat, one of their most popular songs, doesn't sound like anybody at that time, and totally original, totally catchy, one of my favorites.
Yep, that's one of mine, too. It's actually my number one, but so I'm with you. I mean, there's lots of... we could talk about that one for a long time. I remember him calling me and telling me he'd written the best song he'd ever written, and we had to record it immediately, and I didn't hear it for a few days after that. But when I did hear it in a live show, and I knew the moment it started, I said, this is the one Paul called about.
It's over.
And once again, I thought, here he's written a real bona fide hit.
That's awesome. Well, my number one pick, and we're basically done with our hour or whatever. I'd like to just thank Peter Jesperson so much. Check him out at newwestrecords.com. They got a bunch of good stuff coming out this fall. Thank you again, Peter. And my number one pick is Alex Chilton.
Fantastic.
Love the song. Love the Spanish guitar breakdown. Totally an emotional song, especially after Alex just died a year and a half ago. Love the band Replacements. Love the whole scene, the twin tone scene. Yeah, on behalf of Peter Jesperson, I would just like to thank you for tuning into the Andy Dare Show. Learned so much about the whole scene, and I'm looking forward to all the new records on New West Records. Thanks again, Peter. Any last words?
Thanks for asking. It was fun chatting with you.
Cool. Well, let's stay in touch. And on behalf of Peter Jesperson, this is Andy Dare signing off for the Andy Dare Show.
Be sure to like the Andy Dare Show at Facebook at The Andy Dare Show. Follow him at Andy Darer and YouTube at Andrew Martin Dare. Thank you so much for listening.
This song is called Androgynous, and it's originally done by The Replacements. Thanks to Peter Jesperson for doing the interview. 1, 2, 1, 2, 3, 4. Here comes Dick, he's wearing a skirt. Here comes Jane, you know she's sporting a chain. Same hair, revolution, same bill, evolution. Tomorrow who's who's gonna fuss? And they love each other so. Androgynous, closer than you know, love each other so. Androgynous. Happy with the way she looks, you know she's happy with her gender, and they love each other so. Androgynous, closer than you know, love each other so. Androgynous, mirror image, see no damage, see no evil at all. And Cupid dolls and meets girl, they both look the same, they're overjoyed in this world, same hair, revolution, unisex, evolution,